Blog Talk Radio.
Gus T. Renegade in for another program to share constructive information about what racism is and how it works. Thank you, everyone, for tuning into the broadcast. I hope it is constructive. And I want to begin by thanking Khadijah, a longtime listener. She informed me about this particular book that we're going to discuss today and the book's author. Outstanding recommendation. Thank you, Khadijah. Also want to correct one error before we get started. I thanked all of the black males who participated in the Sunday, June 27th broadcast, and I missed one, non-Mighty Wick. I am getting old, forgive, but non-Mighty Wick also, thank you for your participation and candid dialogue. Appreciate it. I want to hop to it because I thoroughly enjoyed the book we're going to discuss today, and I think it just has a ton of great information, and I want to get started. Our guest for today's program, a Pulitzer Prize winner. He is, in addition to being an author, a longtime journalist, a real privilege to have him on the program, and he is the author of the book we're going to discuss today, Buried in the Bitter Waters, The Hidden History of Racial Cleansing in America. Our guest for today's program, Mr. Elliot Jaspin. Mr. Jaspin, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Outstanding, sir. Thank you so much for sharing a bit of your time with us. Really looking forward to getting into your work. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I hope listeners will pick up a copy and read it. Could you share a little bit about yourself for folks who have not, you know, read this book or are not familiar with you?
Well, I've been a reporter for over 40 years, and I was working at Cox Washington Bureau when I started research on this book. My specialty is called computer-assisted reporting. What I do or what I did was I buy up government databases and analyze them for news stories. So, for example, when I was working in Rhode Island, we had several incidents where school buses would stop, the children would get off, and then the school bus would roll forward and kill the children. So as part of my effort to examine this, I got a database of all the school bus drivers in Rhode Island, and I matched that up with a database of all traffic violations, and I found school bus drivers with 10 and 20 traffic violations. I then matched the same list of school bus drivers with criminal court records, and I found school bus drivers who were drug dealers. And I'm very proud to say that after that story ran and they began to vet school bus drivers a lot more closely, as far as I know, there's never been since then a child killed by a school bus that was supposed to deliver him to his family or her family. So that was the sort of thing I did, and that was really at the heart of of this research in this book, what I did was I took old census records and analyzed them, looking for black population collapses. This is where between one census and another census, the blacks in a county would suddenly disappear. And so I was able to identify the counties where this happened, and then I'd go to those counties and go through historical records, and that's where I found that there had been racial cleansings. So that's pretty much my background.
Outstanding. I'm excited to get into it, and again, I hope folks will read Buried in the Bitter Waters, and yeah, we'll get into it. Hopefully this will be a great commercial for the book. You are a white man, is that correct, Mr. Jasmine?
Last time I checked, yes.
Okay. This program, The Cows, Context of White Supremacy, I have unfortunately concluded that we are in a global system of racism, white supremacy. I use those two words interchangeably, and I define both of those words as follows. A global system of
Hello? 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 Hello?
Okay, can I be heard? Greetings, can I be heard? Checking, can I be heard? Mr. Jasmine, are you with us? Very interesting. I'm just checking the lines. Mr. Nero, can I be heard?
Yes, I can hear you guys.
Okay. 4-1. Okay, Mr. Jasmine?
Yeah, hi. You suddenly disappeared.
I must have got disconnected. Hopefully we're all good now. We'll try that again.
Okay.
As soon as I get to definitions are very important. As I was saying before I got cut off from the program, I have concluded that we're in a global system of racism, white supremacy. I use those two terms interchangeably, and the definition that I use for both terms is as follows. A global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you believe that such a system exists, and do you think that definition is accurate?
Are there people in the world that are racist and who would subscribe to that kind of theory? I think absolutely that's true. As to its universality, in other words, how prevalent it is, that's a much dicier proposition. One of the things that struck me in my research was that in almost every county where there was racial cleansing, there was a portion of the black of the white population, and you know it's impossible from the context of today to know how large it was, but there was a section of the white population which fought vigorously and oftentimes at their own great personal risk to prevent these racial cleansings. It wasn't as if every white was part of driving out blacks from a county, which is not to say that they were that whites who were opposed to this were successful. In fact, they were uniquely unsuccessful. So I guess my only question is, or quibble would be that, you know, the universality of it. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir. Excuse me. The global perspective that I have about the system of racism, white supremacy, is more so that every aspect of the planet is dominated by this system, not so much that every white person believes in and practices racism, white supremacy, but the white people who do dominate the planet. That is, there is no way you can go where white people do not dominate the non-white people on this planet. Do you believe that that's true?
I'd have to think about that for a minute. I've never really given that. I mean, it's just something I haven't looked at. I guess I'd have to say I'm a little uncomfortable saying that whites control this planet and everywhere you go, whites are trying to suppress blacks. That seems a little too Manichean for me.
Okay. I do want to point out for the listeners, I didn't say blacks, I said non-whites. Non-whites.
Okay.
But the book, Buried in the Bitter Waters, excuse me. You already shared a little bit of information about how you got started with this project. You didn't name this book. I'm sorry?
I'm sorry. Can I interrupt for a second?
Yeah, go ahead.
Sure. This is maybe a little bit off topic, but one of the things that I came away with from this research, and it might go to what you're talking about, is I came away with a sense, and this is nothing I could prove, that there is bred into us, and I mean baked into the genes, a desire to see, to be, in a sense, tribal, to see our group, whatever that group may be. It could be whites, it could be blacks, it could be Hungarians, what have you. To see our group as unified and threatened, whether they're threatened or not, but threatened by other groups. And as I was doing the research on the book, I started to look at the rise of Cro-Magnon man and the disappearance of Neanderthal man. And I'll admit that this is skating way out on the edge of what you want to talk about, but the Neanderthal was very successful as a race, so to speak, but they were wiped out completely, and they were wiped out completely, and the culprit, I think, is Cro-Magnon man, who did not interbreed with Neanderthal, and I think in all likelihood, hunted down and killed Neanderthal man. Now, we descend from Cro-Magnon, and it again, is simply a speculation on my part, but, I see it again and again in human history where, it could be whites, it could be blacks, it could be Asians, it could be Hungarians, it could be Americans, what have you, they see other groups as the other, and they turn to attack. And so one of my speculation, and it's only speculation, is that this kind of attitude, and it's expressed as racism, as nationalism, is baked right into our genes. I don't know if that's true, but it would also or might go to bolster your argument that that there's this sort of global movement against non-whites by whites. And my speculation is this genetic? I mean, is this was a survival skill so to speak, going back literally thousands of years. I apologize if I am too far off topic.
Not at all. Not at all. I appreciate you sharing. I'm just curious. Are you familiar with Michael Bradley's work, The Iceman Inheritance?
No, I'm not.
Oh, he talks a lot. That's pretty much the foundation of his book, which you just laid out there is the total foundation of his book. He was a guest on the program last year, but I don't know. You might be interested in checking that book out, The Iceman Inheritance, Michael Bradley.
The Iceman Inheritance. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. He's an anthropologist. But, yeah, thank you for sharing. I found that very relevant. I hope listeners did as well. Your book, Buried in the Bitter Waters, you deal a lot with one group, specifically white people, being or feeling that there is some sort of threat from black people and acting in an aggressive manner in response to that threat. I guess I wanted to start with terms. You point out in your book, which I loved, very early on, I think, page 12, language is how we understand things. You did not use disturbing situation. You used the term racial cleansing. Can you kind of share that thought process with our listeners, why you chose that term?
Oh, sure. Yeah. And really, it's to my mind, central to the book and central to the research. One of the things that struck me, as I did this research, was there was a pattern to these racial cleansings, which was, obviously, you have the initial incident where whites issue an ultimatum to blacks, and they say, you know, you must leave in 24, 72 hours a week, or we will kill you. And those threats were successful. And then after that, there comes a period where immediately after the racial cleansing, where typically the white community would look back on this with some pride, you know. And I came across documents and speeches and pamphlets in which the white community would promote their county or their community. And one of the selling points was that there weren't any blacks. And, you know, this was considered really, you know, just wonderful. And that was followed usually a long period of time, 50, 60 years, was followed by a kind of a dawning realization that what had happened, that what Grandpa and Grandma had done was really pretty awful. Then the white community would construct a fable. And the fable would explain that, yes, something terrible had happened, and actually wouldn't even admit that something terrible had happened. Something had happened. And as a result of that, all the blacks left. But no one was injured. And the point of the fable was to absolve whites of any guilt for driving out all these innocent people. And by the time I come along, these fables are deeply embedded in the white community. And I will argue that not only within that community, but more generally among whites in the country. And there are a whole host of reasons for that, but let me just leave it there for this time being. And one of the ways that you enable this fable is through kind of code words and dog whistles. And so there was never a racial cleansing. People just left, or there was a disturbing situation. That was how it was referred to by one person. The disturbing situation involved the death of several people, burning of houses. It was really grotesque, that particular racial cleansing. And when I realized what was taking place here, I decided first we needed to name this thing, to face it. We can't use code words to describe it. We have to describe it accurately. And the closest I could come, and I think it was pretty successful, was that this was a racial cleansing. And of course, that goes back to the war in the Balkans, and at that time it was called ethnic cleansing. But in point of fact, it, I think, very accurately defines what took place. And racial cleansing has been defined by the United Nations, which they did that in terms of ethnic cleansing, but you know, you replace, let's say, Serbs and Croats with blacks and whites, and you really have the same, the exact same thing taking place. And so that's why I use the term racial cleansing. And what was disappointing, but at the same time interesting to me, was that when it finally came time for Cox Newspapers to publish this series, one of the conditions under which they would publish the series in the newspaper was they had to take out the word racial cleansing. And so, you know, it's still that undertow of racist thinking that still controls here. And they could not bring themselves to name what was in fact right in front of their face. And it taught me just how powerful this is as a theme in American life.
Again, Pulitzer Prize winner, author of Buried in the Bitter Waters, Mr. Elliot Jaspin, I have come to the same conclusion that you have, Mr. Jaspin, with regards to how they responded to your story. The folks at Cox Newspapers, Cox Enterprises, I've just concluded it's on a global scale, the system of white supremacy. The interesting thing, I was reading your book, and I didn't have an issue with the term racial cleansing. Great. And as I read, the more I thought about it, I said, wait a minute. Cleansing gives the connotation, denotation of removing dirt, filth. And I thought, I don't know how I feel about that being used to describe acts of racism in ejecting black residents, innocent black residents from a county. And I thought there's got to be a better term. This feels like a term that's supporting white supremacy. And I was trying to think of a more accurate term. And I ended up saying racial expulsion. I could deal with that. And then by the time I got to the end of your book, the people that didn't want racial cleansing, that was the white people that did not want the term racial cleansing in your story. That was the term they wanted, racial expulsion. And I just thought that was really really strange. I had to go back and rethink. I don't know. Have you thought about that? I mean, the connotations of cleansing?
Well, actually, you raise a really good point. And it was the same point that was raised at the time that the term ethnic cleansing was coined. And and the same objection was raised in terms of ethnic cleansing, that it somehow implied that those people who were forced out were, you know, that there was something wrong with them. What's interesting is the history of the word. When ethnic cleansing, when that term was used, it was used by, and I hope I get the groups right here, it was used by the Croats who were being driven out by the Serbs. And it was one of those rare moments in history when usually it's the victor who gets to write the history. And in this particular case, it was the vanquished that got to write the history. And it was their term. It came about at a press conference. I think I discussed this in the book. It was a military term initially, in terms of using the word cleansing, where you drive out the enemy, so to speak. But it was the Croats talking about it in relation to what had happened to them. And it's sort of ironic, and that it was the vanquished who got to describe the term. And there was some debate at the UN, the special rapporteur there who examined this, about whether to use that term for precisely the reasons that you raised. And eventually they went with, you know, the term ethnic cleansing. I find it a really brutal term, but then it describes a very brutal situation. And I eventually decided that it had been adopted by the UN. It was accurate in the sense that it described what had taken place, and it was ironic in that it had been put forth by the vanquished, and so that's why I decided to use it. And it has, and I happily admit it, it has a certain shock value to it, and it certainly has a certain shock value to it when you use the term racial cleansing and America in the same sentence. Because Americans don't like to think of themselves in those terms, that these sorts of things would happen. And, you know, that's just human nature. And I wanted to grab people's attention. So that's the term I went with.
As I've been thinking about it, I thought about it. I mean, you said it's a central theme of the book, the choice of that term, the use of that term, and it, you know, tons of conflict, even for your newspaper story, which I hope we'll get into later in the program. But the more I've thought about it, I feel like all of the reasons that I don't like the term, that's why it's the most accurate term to use, because I think it accurately reflects the thinking of the white people in power and the acts that they carried out. That is exactly the ideology that they had. We are kicking out rubbish. We are removing people who are not of value from this area. And I think racial cleansing, I think, hits it on the head. Wow. Can you share, because I think I really appreciate it, you gave a detailed criterion for what constituted a racial cleansing. You listed, I believe, 260 suspected counties where this could have taken place by the data that you compiled. Can you give the criterion that the specific area had to meet to be classified as an area where racial cleansing took place?
Sure. It had to make the sort of the cut in the book, to be described in the book. First of all, it had to be countywide, and this does not mean that all racial cleansings are countywide. I am sure, in fact, I know for a fact, that there were racial cleansings that were limited to like a town or a city. But for the purposes of this book, it had to be countywide. There had to have been an ultimatum issued by the whites to the blacks. I had to have found evidence of that. Now, sometimes it was written, sometimes it was oral, but I had to have some evidence of that. It had to have been sudden, that it wasn't where there was, you know, racial hostility in a county and over a period of 5, 10, 15 years, blacks in that county said, I'm leaving. This is just not worth living here. It had to be sudden, in a matter of at most a month. And typically these were a matter of days. I think the one that went on the longest was Forsyth County in Georgia, which might have gone over a month, but was, you know, certainly pretty sudden by anybody's standard. And again, for the book's purposes, the county has to have remained white or virtually all white until today. Now, today is not an accurate term in that today was the today when I came upon that county, which would have been, in some cases, 4 or 5 years ago. Those were the criteria that made the cut for the book, so to speak. Now, there were obviously far more racial cleansings than the 12 I describe in the book, or the 260 that were suspected, because those 260 or thereabouts, those were countywide racial cleansings. And as I said, I came across reports of racial cleansings that were confined to just a city or a town. The fact of the matter is, we do not know the extent of this today, because a lot of this history has been hidden, has been forgotten, in putting forgotten in quotes. So there's many, many more than what I describe. But these, the ones that I wrote about, I call them the worst of the worst.
Wow. Wow. For folks listening in, I guess if there are four themes I want you to keep in mind during this broadcast, withholding information, deceptive use of language. I think you've already heard that a little bit. Racial cleansing being described as a disturbing situation, quote unquote. Community, and I'm about to ask Mr. Jaspin about that right now. And the last one, I don't even have to say anything. Can you talk, because this was brilliant. I have heard other people talk about how slaves are not a part of a community, and you touched that in your book and early in the book, and I would have to say it's probably one of the just most poignant and accurate explanations of why a slave cannot be a member of a community. Can you share that with our listeners?
Well, that would have been Washington County in Indiana, and the principal city there, as I recall, was Salem. And this was the earliest racial cleansing that I came across, occurring in somewhere in 1863-64. And what takes place is that in the Civil War, slaves are escaping the South and streaming northwards into places like Indiana. And at the same time, the basis of the war is turning, and Lincoln is saying at some point we have to I want to issue an Emancipation Proclamation and free the slaves, or at least free the slaves in the southern states that were in rebellion, and this has there's a tremendous backlash. There are accounts of officers resigning their commission, and soldiers, refusing to fight on the Union side, because as far as they were concerned, they had gone to war to preserve the Union, not to end slavery. And you see that played out in Washington County, Indiana, which is in southern Indiana, and is at that time, at least, was probably more southern than it was northern in its outlook for a town in a northern state or a Union state. And this was openly discussed and debated in the newspaper at that time, and when the Emancipation Proclamation comes about, the editor, a loathsome person, guy named Heffron, who I strongly suspect, was the leader of the racial cleansing there. But whether he was or he wasn't, he was certainly the spokesman for the Southern cause in that town. He does the calculation in his newspaper. He says, wait a second. If the slaves are freed, then they become citizens. And if they become citizens, they have the right to vote. They become part of the polity. They become us. And, I mean, in terms of white races, I mean, Horace Heffron was Exhibit A. And he and people in Washington County said, no, that cannot be. We cannot allow that. And that becomes, as best as we know, that becomes the impetus for the racial cleansing there. And the thing that is so stunning and disturbing about that is that the black population as it existed at that time in Washington County was tiny. I mean, a few hundred people in a county of thousands. They had absolutely no chance to control the political life of that county one way or the other. But it was that driving force that that they are the other, and we cannot allow them to become us or to be on an equal plane with us. And so they're driven out. And I saw that same operation again and again in other racial cleansings that followed, which is that one of the underlying causes of racial cleansings is that blacks were not allowed to vote. They were not part of the polity. And if you're not part of the polity, then you could be gotten rid of. You were disposable. And, you know, we think of having the right to vote as a political thing, but it's also a social thing. It's a statement about your worth in the community, that you're considered worthy enough to have a say, to have a vote in that community. And that was an extremely strong undercurrent. In Washington County, it was stated. In other counties, it wasn't stated. And yet you could see how it worked, that whites would either fear that blacks would have the vote or would think, well, because they don't have the vote, we can get rid of them. It became the logical basis of the expulsion, insofar as you can describe the expulsions or racial cleansings as having logic.
Wow. I want to get detailed analysis of what happened in Forsyth, particularly because I used to reside in Atlanta, and I have a lot of listeners in that area, and that takes up a lot of the book for your own personal experience as well. Before I do, one of the major components of this book and the racial cleansings, the redundant theme of a black male raping a white woman. Can you kind of share your thoughts on that?
Well, this was, you know, a redundant theme in the racism of that period. It was, you know, it was typically expressed as the burly black brute attacking, you know, the innocent female. There have been several forests that have been cut down to make books describing the psychosexual hang-ups of people at that time, and I really exist to this day with this kind of crazy, I don't know, fear. I don't even know how to quite describe it. But it was, you know, one of the trigger points. And in some cases, you know, in some counties, there was an incident where a black had raped a white woman. But in other cases, there was no basis whatsoever. It was just, it was suspected, or it was assumed, or it was whispered. But it took on a life of its own. And in Missouri, there was a woman was found murdered by railroad tracks, and someone, when they came upon the body, someone said, "Oh, I saw a black person nearby." That's all it took. And then this whole machinery of fear, burly black brute raping white woman, you know, kicked into gear. And it was then assumed that a black had raped and murdered a white woman, and therefore all blacks had to be driven out, or otherwise we wouldn't be safe. I mean, from the perspective of today, I mean, it's completely crazy. But it had it was extremely strong motivation then. There were other reasons for racial cleansings. One of the other really strong motivating forces was economics. If you were a white working man and you got rid of your black counterpart, you restricted the pool of labor, and therefore you could charge more for your labor, and life was a lot better for you. And so, whites would sort of tote up the score, so to speak, and at the end of that calculation, out went the blacks. There were several reasons for driving out blacks. Some stated, some not stated, but when you look at the historical record, it was pretty obvious what was going on there.
Wow, you just touched on economics being a co-variable in what motivated some of these racial cleansings. Before I get to what happened in Forsyth County in Georgia, can you talk about the enticement laws? Because I felt that was important, because you talk a lot in detail about the grinding poverty that a lot of black people experienced during the time of these racial cleansings.
No. Just to step back for a second, and the enticement laws was one of many things that I stumbled across in the research for this book, and as I've told other people, I had what you would call a solid gold education. I went to one of the best high schools in New York State. I then went on to a college that always ranks, in the top small colleges in the United States. And so before I stumbled across this whole subject, I considered myself to be, knowledgeable and well-read and well-educated. And one of the things that kept coming back to me as I did the research for this book was how absolutely ignorant I was of the history of this country. And the enticement laws certainly, center stage. What people are taught in school, or at least when I was going to school, was Civil War ends, and the blacks are freed, and then there's this period where the South is in decline, and then blacks move north, takes jobs in factories in the North, and you know, after World War II, there's enough of a black bourgeoisie to start the civil rights movement, and it all seems, you know, pretty neat and reasonable. And then, as I'm doing this the research for this book, I find that, well, that's not quite the case, and that when the Civil War ends, the blacks are freed, but freed in name only. And instead, what occurs is they construct this legal machinery to reinstate slavery. And when you look at it, you really can come to no other conclusion that slavery continued well after the Civil War. And it was a kind of legalized slavery that both North and South kind of winked at and just sort of shrugged their shoulders and said, gee, that's pretty awful. And what it entailed was, if you were a black living in the South, and you know, typically farmer, farmhand, you signed a contract with the white who owned the land and to work on that land. Now, most contracts are civil contracts. So, you know, I buy a refrigerator from you, I might sign an installment contract. And if for some reason I don't carry out the terms of that contract, or you don't think I carry out the terms of that contract, you'll take me to court, and the worst that can happen is there'll be a civil penalty. These enticement laws and labor laws were criminal in nature. And so if a black man, you know, wanted to quit and to go someplace else to work, because he had signed this contract, he had violated he faced criminal penalties for leaving. And if he faced criminal penalties, typically the penalty was he was sent off to the county farm, which is to say he was a prisoner, and he was truly a slave because his labor then was free to the county. And what the county did was it would then turn around and send this black man to work on a farm. So he's right back where he started from. The only difference now is he didn't even get a pittance of a wage. And also, if I, you know, in the normal world, such that it is, if I wanted to hire you away from your radio station to work at my radio station, I might offer you more money, you know, and whatever else you might want. And you go, okay, I'll go work for this guy and leave my job. Back in the South, during this period, if I offered you more money to work for me, that was considered enticement, and I was therefore criminally liable for luring you away from your employer. And that was really the what undergirded the whole system, was that what had been civil law and civil contracts was now criminalized. And the net effect of this was that blacks remained in slavery well after the Civil War. How longer, you know, that is an interesting academic debate, but it was certainly decades later, which is why you had this rampant poverty in the South among blacks.
And goes right back to what we addressed already. Slaves are not members of a community. They can be disposed of at any time. The racial cleansing in Forsyth, Georgia. I really want to dig into the details of that. As I said, a lot of folks in the Atlanta area listen to this program, and I used to live there too, so I was really interested in this. And this is the second time an author has come on this program and talked about Forsyth County and the just real despicable act that happened there. Rich Benjamin, he's the author of Searching for Whitetopia, and he went to Forsyth County. Book just came out last year, and he went there and talked to all the white folks and talked to them about how their area doesn't really have a lot of non-white people, and they repeated some of the lines that you touched on in your book, an unfortunate situation, so on and so forth. I wanted to, I guess, get some of the context of how all this came to be, even before the racial cleansing that took place as a result of what happened to May Crow. I guess the racial cleansing, before the racial cleansing, the area of Forsyth County was stolen from the indigenous Cherokee population. Andrew Jackson, Trail of Tears, that area has a real ugly history all the way through. Do you want to comment any about the forced removal of the indigenous population, the Cherokee population, before getting to what happened in the early 20th century?
Well, you hit on a very tender point here. As I was doing this book, one of the things I struggled with was, well, what do I do about Indians? What do I do about or Native Americans? What do I do about Asians and other populations that have experienced the same sort of thing? And really, with Native Americans, that was genocidal. I mean, there comes a point where you have to limit your book. You have to focus it. And sometimes you don't really want to. Sometimes you want to, talk about things that are perhaps not central to the book, but, bear the same imprint. And certainly driving out Native Americans out of that part of Georgia, qualifies. I did not do that. And in point of fact, I chose not to write about a lot of racial cleansings, the majority, because at some point you have to stop researching and write the book and tell people what you know. And so I had to stay very focused. But without a doubt, that's a long and very sorry history of what happened to them. One other thing, which you can say is a rationalization, and just may well be, what happened to Cherokees and to other tribes in America has been pretty well explained. Books, movies, what have you. When I sat down to write the book on racial cleansing in America, there literally was not another book that I could find. And as of today, as far as I know, there are only two books, mine and another, called Sundown Towns, which even try to tackle this subject. And so, that was how I kind of decided that this is why I was going to focus it. I certainly could be open for criticism on that.
Oh, no, sir, I wasn't mentioning it as a criticism. I just felt it would be correct to note that the truth of, that's how Forsyth County, that's how it came to be, Trail of Tears right there. Did you want to?
I'm sorry.
Did I interrupt you?
No, I'm sorry. No.
Oh, okay. 1912, Maycrow, if you want to share what happened there, and we can begin with the 1912 racial cleansing involving black folks.
Yeah. Well, this was a case where, from all evidence, there was an assault, a rape by a black man on a white woman, and that was the incident that triggered the racial cleansing. Now, there had been, prior to that, other incidents where of racial hostility, and I document them in a book where there was a work camp where the blacks were, you know, driven out by white workers in that area, and certainly the racism in northern Georgia was a sight to behold during that period. In any case, there's an attack, and a series of blacks were arrested for the attack, and it was a story that grew more and more lurid. With you know, at first, it's the story was that one black man had attacked a white woman, and then it was two, and then it was that there was a group, and they went back and repeatedly raped Maycrow. It's impossible from the perspective today to nail down exactly what happened. I tried, and it was there just wasn't enough there in the historical record that to say in any kind of definitive way what precisely took place. But there was a trial, and two men were convicted, and later there was what turned into a public hanging. And up until that point, I'm sure the black population felt threatened, but there hadn't been an ultimatum. And one of the things that I came across, which was fascinating, and in fact it's a photo that's published in the book, shows the crowd after the hanging. Apparently what took place was the two men were hung, and then the photographer got up on the scaffold, set up his camera, and took a picture of the crowd that was at that point starting to disperse. And when I looked at the photo, what I noticed is that right in the front ranks, there were blacks standing there, you know, obviously talking about, I'm assuming, but it would seem logical to assume that they were talking about what had just taken place. And there were knots of whites, nearby. And what the photo told me was that there was at that point no overt hostility. In other words, that blacks felt comfortable enough to show up for a hanging of black men in a town or a county that was predominantly white. But then, after the hanging, there was a campaign that went on for a couple of months in which blacks were told that you had to leave. There was no place for you in this county. And when I say told, that's being far too polite. The title of the chapter is The Burning Cow, and it comes from a newspaper story that I came across where a vigilante showed up at a farm owned by a black man, and no one was home. So they set up wood around a cow, the farmer's cow and literally burnt the cow alive. And I mean, clear message that that you'd better leave or the same thing would happen to you. And that was the sort of intimidation that took place. Other things that took place was the vigilantes would show up at a farm and just start shooting into the house. Sometimes it was where whites would appear and say, "You have to leave within, you know, 24 hours." There never was a leader identified among the whites who did this. What was interesting here was two things. One was that the white community or the white business community sent a petition to the governor asking for help to protect blacks and to stop this racial cleansing. And, you know, I talked earlier that in a number of these counties where racial cleansings took place, there were whites who stood up to the mob and who were opposed to what took place. Now, what their motivation may be, you know, in some cases we know it was economic. You know, this was labor that we don't want to see leaving. They weren't what you would call altruists. In other cases, whites went at great personal risk to themselves and fought and argued with the mob. Certainly that happened in Corbin, Kentucky, because it outraged their sense of right and wrong. But whatever the reason, in Forsyth County, there was a petition. It was sent to the governor, and the governor turned them down and said, "Sorry, no, this is something you've got to handle." What followed after that was that the racial cleansing that began in Forsyth County spread to other counties throughout northern Georgia. And you saw a massive exodus of blacks who were exodus in the sense that they were being driven out, not that they were choosing to leave. When it was over, the black population in northern Georgia was seriously depleted, and you can still see that the impact of that just by looking at census numbers and comparing one county where there are few if any blacks with the next county over, which has a substantial black population. And so the demographics of that area can only be explained through what took place in this cataclysm that, you know, took place over 2 or 3 months, which is, when you look at it, you know, I'm a person that likes numbers, is pretty stunning. And it was a racial cleansing that was strictly enforced. I came across an account, I believe it was in 1913, where a white family with a black driver drove to a picnic up in a neighboring county whose name escapes me right now. And when they show up at this picnic, there was a near riot, and because the whites said, you know, you cannot bring a black into this county. And the family drove off at the risk of, you know, losing or being injured, certainly, if not, you know, being killed by this mob. And I also found there were, I think it was 4 blacks who tried to move back to Forsyth County a month or two after the racial cleansing, and their homes were dynamited. Pretty clear what the community, you know, how they felt. But I don't know if you want me to go further on that, but that pretty much ends that period of the history of Forsyth County. of the immediate racial cleansing.
I want folks who are listening to this to get a sense of, I mean, what you just described is horrific, but I want people to understand in terms of property laws that blacks suffered as a result of this racial cleansing. I think you wrote in the book on page 135, blacks owned more than 1,900 acres of land in Forsyth County. When these racial cleansings come, you don't exactly get to sell your land, market value, and move on with the profits and purchase real estate elsewhere. Can you kind of talk about that? Because that becomes an integral aspect of the story.
Yeah. Well, the land in Forsyth County was really one of the most fascinating, you know, and it seems odd to talk about land as fascinating, but the fascinating stories, because that becomes the linchpin of the fable that the people in Forsyth County constructed to absolve themselves of any guilt. As you said, at the time, these people were literally running for their lives, and the only thing that they could do was leave anything that they couldn't carry, they had to leave behind, and obviously they left behind the land. And in a sense, that would be kind of, you know, from the standpoint of investigating racial cleansings, would be sort of unremarkable. Of course, you can't take your form with you. But then what happens is that as part of the fable, as absolving their guilt of what took place, whites float the story that is, I found current as of early 2000, that, yeah, the blacks were driven out, and, you know, that was regrettable, but they were paid for their land. And if they were paid for their land, then, in a sense, no harm, no foul. This was repeated again and again, you know, by the local county historians, by people I interviewed. And I was very, very curious as to, you know, what's the truth of this? So I spent several weeks at the courthouse in Forsyth County tracing every parcel of land, black-owned land, in the county. And, in fact, in an addendum to the book, I list every parcel of land and exactly what happened to that piece of land. And I did that if for no other reason than to puncture the balloon of self-delusion that people in Forsyth County like to float, which is, you know, all the land was paid for. No, it was not. The majority of people simply left, and their land was lost, and it wasn't put up for, it didn't go to a sheriff's sale. What appears to have happened was that there was a kind of unwritten rule that if you wanted to squat on that land, it became yours. And so you see these deeds where there's a black owner, and then poof, suddenly it's a white owner, and there's no bill of sale, no deed transferring. It just happens. And there were a few cases where blacks were able to sell their land. There was one which, when I came across it, I kind of chuckled because, this was a really clever guy. There was a black farmer, and he appeared to have been one of the more prosperous black farmers. And what you see in the deed is he, you know, obviously escapes with his life. But before he does, he leases his land to some white landowners or white farmers. And so he's able to have legal ownership of the land, and eventually he sells it. because he could never move back there. But he did what I would say was the smartest job of outwitting the mob. And but that was the exception. For most, you just lost the land, or in some cases you sold it for a pittance. And there were I described these two white entrepreneurs who seemed to have made a business out of getting black-owned land for next to nothing. And in point of fact, I imagine they thought they were being very clever. If they just waited, they could have just taken it. But at the time, they wanted the fig leaf of legality to get this land. Again, as late as when I was writing the book, there were whites who would tell me that, the blacks were driven out, but they got money for their land. Just not true.
Wow. Again, privileged to have our guest, Mr. Elliot Jaston, author of Buried in the Bitter Waters, the black male who was clever enough to lease out his land, Mr. Joe Kellogg. Joe Kellogg was that gentleman's name. I wanted to touch about, because this Forsyth story, the reason that I wanted to focus on it is this is kind of an ongoing saga. I have a photograph of the attempted march in 1987 in Forsyth County, where there's a banner that reads, and you talk about racial cleansing, the banner reads, "Racial purity is Forsyth's security." And there are a group of white people marching with this banner and a Confederate flag or two, it looks like, in the background. This is from page 259 for anyone who thinks, this is over. Why are you all talking about this stuff that happened 100 years ago? This is from page 259 in Mr. Jaston's book. In 1980, when a black firefighter from Atlanta was shot in the neck after he attended a picnic in Forsyth County, one of the men arrested was Melvin Crow, part of the extended Crow family. Asked about his involvement in the shooting, Melvin Crow shrugged and said, "Somebody has got to keep the niggers out of Forsyth County." Again, this is 1980. Do you want to share a little bit about this what took place in 1987, and then we can, I guess, get to your efforts to write about this just a few years ago?
Sure. I'd like to point out here, the Crow family is fascinating in the role that they play in that county, and there's also a tale of redemption here, and it's one of the few things where you find something, I'm trying to think of the word, but that gives you heart, which comes out of the same family. The Crow family clearly was at the center of the racial cleansing that took place back in, I guess, 1912. And central in terms of, I talked to members of the Crow family, and while they were very reticent to, in fact, I interviewed Melvin Crow himself, they're very reticent to talk about what exactly the family did. I came away with the strong impression that, they were, at the very least applauding the racial cleansing. And then you have someone like Melvin Crow, who in the 80s is enforcing the color line in that county. At the same time, there was a member of the Crow family named Esta. Esta Crow later became married, and her name was Esther Weatherford. And though she's a member of the Crow family, she came to reject the legacy of that family. It really takes up the last chapter of my book is the story of Esther Weatherford and how this was, she was not college educated. She was a simple working woman, raised a large family, the kind of person I guess you'd call salt of the earth. And she taught her children and more importantly her grandchildren that what happened there was wrong. And it led to her granddaughter rejecting the legacy of that county. And she understood intuitively what was wrong and rejected that racism. And her actions led to the actions of her granddaughter trying to come to grips with that legacy and trying to make peace with that history, which was done through facing it, talking about it, dealing with it honestly, which is really the only way that we can ever put this past behind us. I may have gotten a little bit off topic here, but in 1987, I believe it was, there was a civil rights march into Forsyth County, which at that time was a white bastion. I mean, it had maintained the color line since the racial cleansing. I interviewed blacks who had to, for various reasons, had to drive through that county. In fact, I talked to the descendant of one of the people who was driven out of that county, and she described in the 80s having to drive through that county because of a family emergency. And she was terrified. And when I interviewed her 5 or 6 years ago, when actually it was longer than that now, you could still hear the quiver in her voice, the fear that she experienced the day that she just had to drive through the county. And it gave me a glimpse at how overwhelming this experience had been in the black community. But only a glimpse. I mean, I never could say that I truly appreciate the horror of this thing that blacks in that area experienced. In any case, they tried to a small civil rights march into that county to protest the racism in that county. And it's met at the border of the county by a potpourri of racist idiots, rednecks, you name it, Ku Klux Klan, local, militia types, and they were threatened and turned back. And of course, 1980s is different than 1912. There was instant national revulsion that this could take place. And people, black and white, from all over the country came to Atlanta and had another march. Now, the first march, I think, was 200-300 people. And they were met with a crowd of, I think, like 400 or 500. The follow-up march was 20,000 people, blacks and whites, marching into Forsyth County, and you know, they were guarded by state police and local police and what have you. But, you know, as stirring as that was, the fact of the matter was it really had no lasting impact. The county remained all white after the march. Nothing much changed, including the attitude of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, which again, I've been a reporter for over 40 years, and it just what they did was just unpardonable. And you know, they peddled stories at the time that you know, described the racial cleansing that occurred as a myth, you know, said, well, we should just, you know, better forget the whole thing. You know, let's just move on from this. Let's not talk about it. And that's been their stance until today. And I believe it'll probably be tomorrow and the next day.
I concur. I want you to talk, and this is in quotes, listeners, I'm not being crude. I want you to talk about the half-assed reporting of the Atlanta Journal and Constitution. This is from page 145. The Atlanta Journal Constitution was next to weigh in on the reparations question. This is reparations for the property that was lost in this racial cleansing of 1912. In a front page article in June 1987, the reporter Mike Christensen called the Forsyth County racial cleansing a legend, unquote. Christensen found that some blacks, he did not say how many, remained after the racial cleansing. Because not every black had left, he declared that Forsyth County's racial history, as it gradually unfolds from the courthouse documents and state records, is not quite living up to its 75-year-old reputation. Can you speak in a little more detail about this half-assed reporting of the AJC?
The irony of this is I actually worked with Mike Christensen in the Washington Bureau of Cox Newspapers, and, you know, went to lunch with him. I had no idea that he'd ever written this. The only thing, and the only way I can square with this with the guy I knew, and he was, you know, was an affable guy. I mean, there was nothing that I, you know, he was likable. The only way I can come to terms with this is that he was trying to do, take the pose of being a mythbuster. Well, there's this myth that they drove them all out. Well, it's not exactly true. And I think reporters like to do that, even when it is as wildly inappropriate as it was in this case. But there's a larger point here, and it has not so much to do with Mike Christensen as it has to do with the paper itself and the people who run that paper. Because stories just don't appear in newspapers. A reporter doesn't write something and, you know, and then it automatically appears. It goes through several edits. And editors at any step along the way can raise questions or raise objections and say, no, this will not appear in the paper. The fact that this appeared talks more about the attitude and the management of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. And as I was as I came to realize, the attitude of the management of Cox newspapers. And I think that's really where the attention should be focused, and where I clearly feel blame should be laid. This story was a piece of, a pattern of shoddy, small-minded reporting and editing and of editorial opinions. I cited editorials where, they just said, well, we let's just not talk about this. And in point of fact, when I produced the series on racial cleansings in America, and obviously part of that was Forsyth County, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution refused to run it. Not a word of my series has ever appeared in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. And it was the management of Cox newspapers which decreed that the term racial cleansing could not appear in the series, no matter where it was printed and which Cox newspaper. I was lambasted by one of the top editors at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. I was ordered to go to Austin, Texas, to meet with a guy named Klibanoff, who was an editor at the AJC, and became my major protagonist within Cox newspapers. And there's a wonderful irony here, which people are probably not aware of. Klibanoff, threw cold water on the whole series and said I hadn't proven that blacks had their land had been expropriated by whites, and led really a personal as well as professional attack against me. Ironically, the same year that this story did not appear in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, he and Gene Roberts, who was former editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer, won the Pulitzer for a book on reporting on race in the South during the Civil Rights era. And I to this day am just astounded by that. But there it is. The Cox newspapers wanted to submit my series for awards, and among them they wanted to put it in for a Pulitzer, and I told them no. And I'm very, very happy and comfortable with that, because I felt that the series that ran in Cox newspapers perpetuated the kind of dishonesty in the discussion of race that has gone on for decades in this country. And I thought that the idea of trying to submit this for an award was obscene. There you go.
I want to quote you directly here. This is page 256, talking about your experience with this piece and Cox newspaper. The failure here runs deeper than a breakdown in institutional checks and balances. The failure is one that mirrors a larger problem of American society. Despite the company's good faith efforts over a period of years to promote diversity, it is striking that everyone involved in the key decisions regarding the series was white. A century earlier, segregation, disenfranchisement, and racial cleansing had established a white man's country. And one of the legacies of this white hegemony was an all-white group of managers who, in an unself-conscious irony, now grappled with how to talk about America's history of racial cleansing. Page 256. The thing that stuck out to me, in my view, I don't know these people. I don't know their motivations, but as you said, it matches a consistent pattern of how white people who do believe in and practice racism, white supremacy, have behaved in this area of the world for centuries now. I suspect that this could have been conscious racism, white supremacy, in an effort to not speak honestly about what happened in Forsyth in 1912. Now, I'm not saying that that definitely is, but I strongly suspect that it could be, because this is pretty much the exact same thing that they did in 1912. The governor said, I can't do anything about this, when they asked about reparations, when this incident flared up just a few years ago. Exact same thing the governor said in 1912. I can't do anything about this. You'll have to settle that on your own.
No, I disagree. As I made as clear as I could in the book, the people that I dealt with at Cox Newspapers were just not racist. They're just not true. In fact, Cox has tried, and I think sincerely and very hard, to promote diversity within the company. And I'm sure that they were really stung by this whole controversy. And I know for a fact, I mean, the top managers at Cox prior to this blow-up were looking at my series as a way to encourage blacks to apply for jobs at Cox Newspapers, and as a way to show that this was a company that was open and, you know, all the usual words for diversity. That said, okay, and I define a person who's a racist as someone who believes that, the superiority of one race over another, and that absolutely in no way describes the people that I dealt with. And people I, didn't like and don't like to this day, and so they're not pals of mine, but I would never, ever describe them as racist. That said, I talked earlier about how there's this, for lack of a better word, this undertowed history, and it's these this sense of things. So, for example, the fact that blacks were not allowed to vote, therefore they were not part of the polity, therefore they were expendable. Now, people wouldn't sit there and think that through. They wouldn't, my guess is if you asked somebody back in the 1860s or 1870s, is this why you're driving blacks out, they'd kind of look at you and just be puzzled. That wouldn't make sense. And yet, it was influential. And it was sort of the air that they breathe that led them to do things that were just, terrible. In the same sense, these people, they lived in, I don't know if it's changed at Cox, I have no idea, but at the time, they lived in a world where everyone they talked to was white. There was, among the top management, no diversity. And there wasn't somebody there, let's say like yourself, to say, hey, wait a second, what you're doing here is not the right thing. I mean, have you considered X, Y, and Z? And if there had been somebody there to make that case, to make that argument, things might have turned out differently. But there wasn't. And the reason that there wasn't didn't specifically have anything to do with the racism or lack of racism of the people in that room. It was that history had delivered them to that place. And they were making decisions that were influenced by their past. And that's, you know, that is why I'm, you know, so passionate about this book, is our past controls us to an extent that we don't realize. And it prescribes our discussion on certain things, and shuts off our debate, simply because we don't realize that we've grown up in that kind of soup, so to speak, and we're so accustomed to thinking in one particular way that it just never occurs to us that there might be a case for X or Y or Z. And that's what went on here, I believe. And in some ways, that's far more insidious than, you know, the blatant racist, you know, screaming, you know, nigger go home or that sort of thing. And, you know, that's why it's important for us to face this history.
We have a ton of folks called in. I want to give them an opportunity to ask questions about this excellent book, extremely informative. But I do want to respond. Again, as I said, I don't know Mike Christensen. You said you worked with the gentleman, and you said he was a good guy. I don't know anybody that worked at Cox Newspapers or the AJC. But I would have to say that, number one, my definition for a racist is different from yours. My definition of a racist is a white person who consciously and or unconsciously, directly and or indirectly, mistreats someone because they are not white. In my view, the conduct of the white people at Cox Newspapers perpetuated the mistreatment of black people, an act of racism. Now, whether they did it consciously, unconsciously, I don't know. But the end result was it supported the system of racism, white supremacy, and it continued the legacy of racism in Forsyth County. I would also say, just going back to what you said at the beginning of the program, you said that you suspect that it could be in the genes of people to look at the world as I have a group and to form some sort of group solidarity and to perceive a threat from people who are not members of that group and to respond aggressively to those others. I think your entire book evidences the people who perceive and behave in this manner are white people. It doesn't tell, your book doesn't evidence black people perceiving themselves as a group and responding aggressively against white people as a group. It's the exact opposite. White people acting in a group aggressively against non-white people who are considered others, less, and worthy of being racially cleansed to keep the white race pure. And I would say that the pattern of behavior at Cox Newspapers, exactly what I said at the beginning, I wanted listeners to keep in mind, withholding constructive information and deceptive use of language. You said they did not want the term racial cleansing. You said that they wanted the vaguer terms, very much akin to a disturbing situation that don't accurately reflect the nature of what took place in Forsyth County. And I would relate it to the exact same thing as what you write about in your book. Linda Ledbetter, history teacher in Forsyth County, Central High School, page 150, exactly what you said. I'm just going to read your book and we can hit the phone lines. If students ask her about the racial cleansing, she pretends ignorance. When they ask about the signs that warned blacks not to let the sun set on them in Forsyth County, Ledbetter said, "I'm like, I don't know. I wasn't here. I didn't see the signs." In fact, she does know what happened. My grandmother was 13 when they had the hanging. She told us all about it. She thought it would be a lot of fun because she would get to meet a lot of new people. She said it was horrible because one of them didn't die real quick. She said one of the men just broke his neck. The other man didn't break his neck, and he just struggled. It was horrible. Very, very, very horrible. But she doesn't tell the truth, and that's the exact same thing. The white people that you work with and who subverted your material did at Cox Newspaper. And I would say Linda Ledbetter and all of those white folks, including Mike Christensen, consciously or unconsciously, they're practicing racism, white supremacy, when they obfuscate and deceive about the history of racism in Forsyth County.
Well, I could respond to that, but there, you said there are people waiting. Although, I mean, it's a very interesting discussion. I've got to say, I've been interviewed by a lot of people on the book, and this is far and away the most interesting discussion I've had on this. And I don't agree with, you know, with some of the points that you're taking, but it's a fascinating discussion. And I'm glad that you've had me on the show.
I'm glad you shared with us. Most of the folks that come here, they don't agree with everything I say. So that's, you know,
nope.
Consistent, if nothing else. Consistent, if nothing else. But I will get the callers, though.
Sure.
Let's see. First name called in, last four digits, 5128. 5128. If you have a question for Mr. Jaspin, your line is open.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call, Gus. I would like to ask the author, obviously when you were doing the research and writing this book, you knew that there would be, I guess, for the families and even the ancestors of the people that you chronicled that were cleansed, quote-unquote, obviously would open up, I guess, wounds, for lack of better terms. I guess in writing the book, what was your, I guess, expected or your hoped for, I guess, outcome? I mean, I guess what was the motivation or what did you hope that would come from writing the book?
Well, in my wildest fantasies, I was hoping that it would help to trigger a more general discussion of what took place. And by general discussion, I mean that there would be academics who historians who would take a closer look at this history and help to document other racial cleansings and to fill in this sort of blank page in our history. That there would be that it would trigger discussion among in the communities where these racial cleansings took place, I thought, gee, with the passage of time, maybe people could finally come to grips with this. That proved to be totally unrealistic, I also wanted to, in a sense, lay down a marker. I wanted to make sure that no matter whatever else happened, that these people that were driven out, that their story would be told. and that there would be some permanent record, that they just wouldn't disappear into history. In the last case, in that I succeeded, I think. Those who disagree with the book or those who like the book, no matter where you fell on that spectrum, I don't think that anyone can deny that this took place, that this happened. And if anybody does, other people can hold up this book and say, well, here it is. And it is totally factual, and there's all kinds of citations. I think the case is just overwhelming. This took place. And, what the future does with it, who knows. Does that help or answer the question?
I'm going to double check with that gentleman. A lot of people call, so I want to try and get as many folks
sure.
an opportunity to ask questions as possible. Person called in with a blocked number. It's a couple of you. First person that called in with a blocked number, your line is open. Did you have a question, or are you just listening? Person
Hello?
With a blocked number. Oh, we can hear you. Yes, sir.
Oh, thanks for taking our calls, Gus. Yeah, I had a couple of questions, but I'm just going to ask one, and maybe if I get a chance to ask the second one, that'll be okay. Mr. Jospin, when you were talking about the government databases, my question is, are there any programs that you know of where you can input data and maybe get some type of moving graph where you can see how the changes are being made? I'm just interested in, is anybody making data easier or programming any systems?
Not in the sense that you're talking about, but the answer is, however, yes. Give you a couple of examples. When I was doing the research, I would compare two censuses, and where there was a black population collapse, I knew that something had happened, but I wasn't sure what. And what I had to do was go to a microfilm reader and go through literally every day of the newspaper for that county until I came across, the story on the front page, typically, which says, today we drove all the blacks out. And I got to tell you, that is the most tedious work you can imagine. Well, the federal government and also some private companies are taking all of the old newspapers that I looked at on microfilm, and they're putting them on, digitizing them, and it allows you to search by terms. So I could put, for example, the word Negro and Exodus, and say, I want to see for this county, for this newspaper, I want to see any stories where those two words appear together. If that had existed when I was doing my research, probably would have saved my eyes. It would certainly have saved me a huge amount of time. And not all newspapers today are being digitized, but have been digitized, I should say. But the goal is to digitize all these old newspapers, and that's a real step forward. In terms of graphing, where you could take a look at a county, there is some graphing capability that has been added to the historical census data, but it's not quite what you're describing, although it is it's kind of nifty. It's kind of a mixed bag. Work has been done in this area.
Buckeye Drifter, calling all the way from the United Kingdom. If you have a question for Mr. Jaspin, your line is open. Sky Drifter, did you have a question? I see a hand up. Did you have a question for Mr. Jaspin? Sky Drifter, I'll check again. Did you have a question, or are you just listening? Might be having some difficulties. I can't hear you at this point. I'll check back if we have a second. But, you got people from the U.K. listening in. Mr. Nero, did you have a question for Mr. Jaspin?
Greetings. Mr. Jaspin, thanks for coming on the show, sir. I'm just curious. After all the research that you have done, how do you feel about the prospective group that you were born into now?
The prospective group? You mean how do I feel about being white?
Yeah, absolutely.
No different than I did before this research. Take any street full of people. There are good people on that street, and there are people who are, sort of mediocre, and there's some real clunkers. It's part of being human. I don't know if that answers your question, but I don't feel, if what you're asking is, do I feel ashamed about being white? No. Do I applaud it? No, not particularly either. Sort of like, do you applaud being human? You're human, with all that implies.
Somebody else called in with a blocked number. Most recent person to call with a blocked number. Your line is open.
I'm tuning in on the tail end, so no questions, but thank you, Mr. Jaspin, for being on the show.
Oh, my pleasure.
Outstanding. I'm going to check Skydrifter one more time, and then Cree has a question as well. Skydrifter, did you get things worked out? Did you have a question, sir? Your line is open. Did you have a question? Not hearing you. I might be able to check that out. I will see if I can get that taken care of in the meantime. Cree, if you have a question, I'm getting your line on right now. Non-Mighty Wick, did you have a question? While I'm getting the Cree, Non-Mighty Wick, did you have a question? Okay, I think he's just listening too. No problem. And I'm having to work hard on the switchboard today. Okay, Cree, your line should be opening if you have a question for Mr. Jaspin. Cree, are you there with a question? Switchboard is showing that you're there now.
I'm here. I don't know if you can hear me.
Yes, we can hear you. I did hear you.
Oh, okay. Yes, Mr. Jaspin, thank you so much for coming on the show. I have found this to be incredibly informative and interesting interview, and I am definitely going to read this book. Earlier you were talking about the pockets, and they almost seem like you can't. You can't hear me, huh?
You're sort of fading in. Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, my God. I just heard myself, but it was on a delay. What's going on?
I heard you, Kareem.
You know what's going on? Okay, I'm assuming you can hear me now, and that what's in my ear is a delay. I don't know what's going on, Gus. I've never experienced this before, but I can hear myself as I talked earlier, but I'll just ask the question now. Okay, and then I'll just try to listen in later, assuming that you can hear me. The question I had was about the bubbles. You studied certain counties, and you found all this purging going on, all this killing. And it is, I think even you said, it's unlikely that that was the extent of the purging and killing, the so-called cleansing. And so you had large groups of white people who didn't mind, it seems, killing. In fact, it did it gleefully, killing black people in order to get rid of them so that they don't have to see them. And given that, you know, people don't to, you know, the question I have is why didn't they, since they had the power and obviously they had the intent, even if it wasn't all white people, they had the power and they had the intention to kill black people so they didn't have to look at them. Why do you think they didn't? Why do you think they didn't kill all black people and just be done with it? And I guess moving it forward, assuming that, you know, people haven't evolved that much, there's probably a critical mass of people who have the same sentiments and obviously have the ability to do it. Why do you think that they just don't go ahead and get rid of us all once and for all?
Okay. It's the two questions. One is relates to what took place back then. The other is what relates to what's taking place today, or at least that's how I'm interpreting your question. As far as back then, it's a good question and an interesting observation. Why didn't they just and they could have easily done it in a county where there are 400 or 500 blacks, just kill them all. And I can only speculate on that. I mean, I didn't come across anything written which said, well, we did it this instead of that. But my guess is because it would shock the conscience that even then, when racism was at a fever pitch, there were things that you just didn't do that were unthinkable. I mean, when American troops, or Allied troops, I should say, rolled into Nazi Germany and discovered the concentration camps, up until that point, what they did was just unthinkable. The mechanization of killing, there had been, you know, genocidal moments, you know, pogroms and what have you, where one group slaughtered another group, but the industrialization of killing, that had been beyond the pale. Well, I think by the same token, the idea that you could simply slaughter everybody was simply, it was unthinkable. You could certainly, you know, kill, lynch, what have you, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, more. But just murdering everybody, again, I'm speculating. As far as today, we're coming to an understanding, certainly in this country, of how just stupid racism is, and just how completely useless as an idea, a doctrine, what have you. Just even raising the issue to say that, you know, well, how come whites haven't killed all the blacks? I mean, it to me is just a repulsive thought. I mean, certainly come farther than that to even raise that as a question. I got to say, I'm just sort of astounded by it. It just is. It's sort of like saying, you know, well, how come, you know, when you're hungry, you don't eat your grandmother? I mean, come on. That is so far beyond the pale. It's not even a question at the, this day and age. And thank God it isn't.
If you got time for one last question, I believe Skydrifter, I think we got his mic corrected. Skydrifter, if you want to get your question in, go right ahead.
Yes, can I be heard?
Loud and clear.
Thank you very much, Gus. Mr. Jaspin, thank you for taking time to come on the show and share very insightful information. I just wanted to ask you a question in regards to your findings. And the question is, have you held any lectures, talks, or any collective kind of meetings, conferences, or whatnot, based on your findings?
Oh, yeah. I've spoken at universities, spoke at Vanderbilt, gave a lecture there, up in Upper New York State, talked there. I was invited to speak to HUD officials down in Atlanta. So yeah, I've spoken, you know, several places around the country.
So I could only really assume that you've spoken to a number of people of different racial classifications. So you've spoken to white people, you've spoken to groups of, or maybe a mixture of different people.
Mm-hmm. Right.
In doing so, what have the responses been from people classified as white? What have the adverse responses been? How have they taken your information?
It's been sort of all over the map, ranging from interest to indifference to sort of. There was one group I spoke to, which they seemed kind of sullen. And this was at a school that was, I'm going to say, almost all white. They didn't seem particularly thrilled. And then there was the HUD managers down in Atlanta, which is a mixed racially group. I got a standing ovation, which I really, you know, that was really cool. I found that you really can't even begin to predict what the reaction might be. I don't know if that
okay,
helped.
And no, that's fine. And Gus, if I may, do you mind if I ask one more question?
Feel free.
Thank you. This is bouncing off of the previous caller's question. Do you believe, or maybe believe isn't the right word to use, but do you feel or suspect as if, with the exception of you know, racist or, you know, white supremacist groups such as KKK, over here we have the Combat 18, White Wolves, and all these, you know, overtly racist groups. With the exception of that and them not wanting, you know, non-white or people of color to actually be around them or exist, do you feel as if other than those particular groups, cliques, organizations, do you feel as if there are other groups or cliques or collectives of people that may have or share the same sentiments as those that are overtly racist, but yet practice their racial beliefs in a very covert manner. Do you see that? Although you did say we have progressed in this day and age, do you see that an existing
factor? Absolutely. I mean, no question about it. Exhibit A would be, in my mind, the Tea Party movement here in the United States.
Thank you.
They do it all, you know, with kind of code words and a wink and a nod. But boy, it comes through to me loud and clear. This is not a group that applauds a multiracial society, a diverse society. The one thing that I astounds me to this day is the fact that Pat Buchanan is allowed to appear on MSNBC, and you know, to give credence to I think where you're driving at. Why is this man, who's an anti-Semite and a racist and just an odious person, and yet he appears on a national program regularly and is asked his opinion, and why anyone listens to that boob is beyond me. But he obviously appeals to a certain segment of the population. I'm guessing a segment of the population that is overtly racist, and then a segment of the population that you're talking about, which is covertly racist. I think that we as a society have turned away from that. I mean, they are in the minority, and they're headed for the dustbin of history. There's no question in my mind about that. But do they exist yet? Absolutely, and I'll offer Pat Buchanan as Exhibit A that they exist.
Great. Thank you, everyone who called in. Outstanding questions. Mr. Jaspin, thoroughly enjoyed the book, Buried in the Bitter Waters, The Hidden History of Racial Cleansing in America. I hope folks listening to the program read this book. Incredibly informative. Thank you so much for sharing a bit of your Thursday evening with us. Really, really enjoyed the conversation, sir.
Ditto for me. I really had a good time. I'm really happy that you invited me on.
For sure. I'm glad. One of my listeners, I didn't know anything about your work. One of my listeners, she sent me a list, and she raved about your book. She said she read it and said you would make a great guest. I concur, Khadijah. Outstanding guest. Outstanding book. If you do any more works about racism, I definitely would love to chat about it and have you back on the program.
Okay. Well, thank you. I'd be happy to appear.
Outstanding. Again, Mr. Elliot Jaspin, author of Buried in the Bitter Waters. We'll take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. Context of White Supremacy.
He's back.
The irritated G of Southeast. Every black person should know and understand what they're putting in their minds when they listen to radio, watch television, and go to the movies.
The Children of Southampton present Entertainment, Fighting the Poltergeist, Saturday, July 10th, 2010, featuring the irritated genius Southeast at the Shanghai City Cultural Center, 3117 Master Street, Philadelphia, PA. Classes start at 12 noon. Class 1, the history of entertainment, what it is and how it works. Class 2 starts at 3 p.m., deciphering plots and themes. Class 3 starts at 6 p.m., The Matrix Made Easy, reading the true messages in what you see. Come on out, black family, to Shanghai City Cultural Center, 3117 Master Street, Philadelphia, PA, on Saturday, July 10, 2010, to hear Entertainment Fighting the Poltergeist, featuring the irritated genius Southeast. This is a free event for the entire black family. For more information, contact 888-817-3235. That's 888-817-3235.
Context of white supremacy, Gus T. Renegade, ahead. No intention of hanging out past the two-hour mark today because I have another show tomorrow and as well as this weekend. But there are a lot of people on the line right now. I think it's almost 10 folks on the line right now. I will concede 25 minutes, so 6:35. I don't care if the cure to racism and white supremacy comes up at 6:34. You better get it out in 60 seconds because I'm dipping at 6:35. The program tomorrow is at 5 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Central, 2 p.m. Pacific, Steve Silverman, and tomorrow, that's an important program. He's with Flex Your Rights. They do all this work on how you should conduct yourself, what to say, what not to say, codifying your behavior when you have contact with enforcement officials. Let me say that one more time. Codifying your behavior, what to say, what to do, what not to do when you have contact with enforcement officials. Steve Silverman tomorrow. I guess for Skydrifter, see if I can get that accurate, that would be 10 p.m. for Skydrifter, 10 p.m. Eastern tomorrow. Yeah, and I'll be quiet since so you all have 24 minutes. 24 minutes. Everybody that called in, your mic is open.
Hello, Gus. Yeah, I had a different question. Nero kind of touched on it, but I did want to ask him about that the data programs. Because I had seen this program, and I can't find it, and I thought maybe he would have some information on it, where they were inputting data, and you can see it in like a graph instead of just looking at it, you know, the information, it would give you a graph, and it was a moving graph. So, you know, the population moving, you know, the exodus and the of blacks in certain areas. But I can't find the programmers or the company that that made this that produced this program. So I thought he would.
If you email me your question, I can send it to him because he might have more info on that. In the book, he talks about how he started getting data to compile this book, and he basically wrote a program, it says in the book. He wrote a program that would crunch the numbers and would spit out a table showing where there were counties where there was a 50% decline, I believe that was the number, a 50% decline in the black population in that county. So he might have info on that. If you shoot it to me, I can pass it along to him.
Get in the bed, sweet.
What'd you say? Whoever the female was, what did you say?
I'm sorry, I thought I was on mute. I'm sorry, I was talking to the dog, so sorry.
Oh, no problem. Everybody that called in, your line is open. Everybody that called in.
Yeah, Gus.
Yes, sir.
When did he say at the beginning of the show that racism and nationalism is baked into the genes of a survival skill? The first thing that I thought about or that crossed my mind was the Kress color theory.
He said quite
that was.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. No, sorry.
Finish your thought, sir. I'm sorry.
No, that was just the first thing that just crossed my mind. You know, it's just. You know, and I'm glad you actually brought up Michael Bradley, you know, the Iceman inheritance in regards to that. Because the whole reason behind doing that is, or the racial cleansing in regards to what they did was based upon fear. can only suspect that he was based upon fear. And it's interesting that he didn't really, you know, touch that on that matter of fear of white genetic annihilation.
What I thought was interesting is the two little sidebars that kind of seemed out of place. He even lost his thought when he was trying to defend the Cox, I mean, the Crow family, and Cox the paper.
Yeah, yeah. He was scratching to find a white person. See, there's a good white person. There's a good white person.
Yep. To the point where it was just, he even felt uncomfortable. He's just like, oh, I done forgot. I don't know what I was saying. I just was trying to.
I think the term skating, I think that was the term he used. I'm skating.
Hey, 909.
Yes, sir.
909. What color is a crow?
What part of the what?
What color is a crow?
I can't understand what you're saying. If you say it slower.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, just say it a little bit slower.
Okay. What color is a crow?
Oh, okay. Yes, black.
There it is. was it a form of self-hatred? And, you know...
Yeah, you know, dragging out some member of the Crow family that the grandmother and whatnot. Yeah, I like when white people do stuff like that because, like he said, it was just so out of place. You know what I'm saying? You look stupid trying to basically defend these institutions, these families. Racist white supremacist. You could go ahead, keep on trying, but you basically, you know, your reputation is at risk. So
that's how he ends this book too, talking about the female, her ancestor, talking about her. Yeah, it was. I thought that was quite interesting.
And I wanted to ask him, too, what percentage of white people in a county, what percentage is enough to run the black people out? You know what I mean? Like, what percentage of whites does it take to, you know, do this racial expulsion? Because he was trying to say that, you know, not all the white people were with it, you know. But I'm just wondering, you know, what percentage, I mean, if it's only a minority, couldn't the majority of whites basically outgun, outman the minority?
Mm.
So, I mean, how many whites do it take to really get it, cracking, you know what I'm saying? I'm just kind of wondering myself, you know.
See, I think that's a really good question because obviously it was the effective majority, right? There are people who were not opposing it, or there were people who were actively engaging in it. It, you know, there wasn't an effective number of people opposing it, so.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, as regards the word cleansing, I find that a really interesting term because I'm reading about the situation down there in Brazil, and they use that term a lot, purge the blood, clean the blood. Various people can't or couldn't do certain things because their blood wasn't clean enough, meaning white enough. And I saw something again in that book that were, they were talking about white people in Brazil. They actually cited a study that repeated something that I heard for the first time fairly late in life a couple years ago, that a lot of white people think about black people. I did not know that a lot of white people, and that includes some people who call themselves Hispanic, say that black people stink. That what they say is that even, they say no matter how many showers or baths they take, they could have just taken a bath or a shower. Because I've heard them say this. I had a person who calls herself Mexican, Puerto Rican, tell me that a lot of Mexicans say that, hey, black people stink. That even it doesn't matter how many baths or showers they take, they stink right after one. There's just a bad smell to us. And so I had to think, well, one of two things is true. Either psychologically, they have processed their distaste for us in such a way that it seems like it physically manifests as an odor. In which case, you know, there again, you're dealing with a situation where they have conceptualized whatever threat we hold as a dirtiness, an uncleanliness, or it's just possible that we really do have an odor to them because we're so genetically different than them. And I've heard some black people tell me the same thing, that white people stick to them. But, it's just, the whole not smelling bad and cleansing the blood and being dirty and ethnic cleansing, it's just a real interesting confluence of words and ideas.
It's like the mold on the white bread, that Gus mentioned.
Well, I've been black all my life, and I haven't smelled a lot of stinky black people. I've smelled people from other countries that, you know, don't use the toiletries we use over here, but I can't say a group of people smell a particular way, though I've heard people say certain things about white people as well, but my observation has been that black people, at least the ones I've been around, tend to be hyper-vigilant about cleanliness and body odor and potions and lotions and colognes and things like that. And in Tom Burrell's book Brainwashed, he says that is a response to the constant stereotyping about us, you know, stinking or smelling.
Well, I will say...
Right, I was... Go ahead.
I was just thinking about pheromones and the fact that when you're attracted to somebody, your olfactory senses definitely play a big role in triggering the brain to go towards that person.
Good point. Good point. And that could be sort of I guess that would be a form of reaction formation. I'm not the psychology major. But if the pheromones are turned on, and see, this would be all processing unconsciously, which the brain, you know, does do. I think the Scientific American a couple weeks ago talked about that, the stimuli to, you know, our five senses, which are processed unconsciously. And they're processed, they have the greatest effect on brain chemistry when the person doesn't even know they're receiving the stimuli. They've done that with people who are, like, blind because of brain injury and not because of their eyes, so they've done a lot of research on that. But at any rate, let's suppose, I mean, really like as a thought experiment, what if that were the case, that they were really receiving these olfactory pheromone stimuli that also trigger for them sexual attraction but danger because of that sexual attraction, so that it then converts in the mind as, the, you know, black people stink.
And I was surprised to hear that, because I could say as far back as being 12 years old and going to Mexico, I've always been hit on by Mexican men. I've the only mistreatment I've ever received by anyone that was Mexican, or I would say Hispanic, generally it was from females. But I've never really had bad experiences like that or heard horrible things outright from Mexican people that I've come into contact with.
Yeah, that would serve to substantiate sort of that kind of theory that I think it's 909. I think that's your nickname. Is that true? Anyway, that would serve to substantiate sort of the basis of the statement black people stink. Because I mean, I have not. You know what's interesting is that I lived that many years. I mean, I only I could, without ever hearing that. I never heard that. And I was around a lot of white people for most of my life. Never heard that. The first time I heard it, interestingly, was this this same female, the same Mexican Puerto Rican female, speaking with me about difficulties that a black male that we both knew was having with Mexican males. I never heard it, you know, in my life, but when it came to talking about why they didn't like him, that's what came up. They were saying, you know, they didn't like him for this reason or that reason, and, you know, she said, quote unquote, Mexicans are really prejudiced, and then she launched into this whole long list of things that Mexicans say about black people, you know, black people are lazy. But then I heard for the first time that statement, you know, Mexicans think black people stink, right? And I had never heard that before, but it's interesting that the first time I heard it was in the context of a black male being disliked by, you know, these questionable people, the people of questionable racial classification status.
Well, I'll say this. I know Puerto Ricans. I was just speaking about this with one of my neighbors, but generally Puerto Ricans and Mexicans and people we would call Hispanic from different regions, a lot of times they'll say similar things about each other as well.
Gus, do I have a second?
There are 9 minutes.
Oh, I guess so. I just wanted to bring up this undertow of history that Jaspin brought up to try to justify some of these practices by, you know, like Cox paper and whatnot and things like that, saying that it was a matter of history. It seems to me that if you're going to be, you know, intellectual and you're going to use your brain, you should, this so-called undertow of history, you should be trying to like the term privileged. Basically, I would rather, I mean, I don't agree with it, but I'm just saying it's overprivileged. So when you have something that's so far out, you should be thinking, okay, yeah, I might be affected by this history or whatever, and you should be trying to go the totally opposite way of your thinking if you really want to solve problems. So I just don't buy this. I'm just saying the undertow of history is not an excuse if you're going to use your brain and call yourself, you know, human or whatever. That's all I wanted to say.
Mr. Nero, I don't know if you are in a spot where you can chat, but if you want to finish up your story that got cut off on the last broadcast about Stedman and Oprah and the deal they made to get the dog, we got about 8 minutes. I know Cree and I were both interested in hearing the conclusion of that story. If you want to finish that up, that would be cool, if you're able.
Gus, I don't think I'm able right now, but hopefully I can get someplace in about three minutes.
Okay.
Mr. Nero,
thank you for remembering that.
Oh, I know what you guys are talking about. He got cut off. Gus, that show you did with Dr. Kevorkian, it didn't record the whole show. Were you aware of that or no?
I think we got cut off.
The end.
Yeah, we got cut off. Just sometimes I will try to just let the conversation go to see if it gets to a natural stop point before the broadcast stops. And sometimes I fail, sometimes I'm successful, you know.
That was a wonderful show.
So what? Replace white supremacy with justice immediately.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
The reason why is because...
Go ahead, Scott Drifter. Sorry.
The reason why is because it's allowed me to look at things in a more insightful way, in terms of, you know, the visual, in regards to the visual perspective with movies. Because at times you do tend to drift away and fall into you know, the characters, and you do empathize with the characters. And but if you don't, you know, look at it in an encompassing way, then. But yeah. Point being that, yeah, it was a very, you know, constructive show. And I share a story with you guys. I'm going to share it. last week, we were on the way to see a friend, and the football was on. England were playing, and I don't really know if you tend to know much about football culture over here, but I can say that the people are very prideful of the nation, and them winning. But in saying that, hopped onto a train carriage. I was the only non-white person on that carriage, and the comments that were left. It's very interesting when you're the only non-white person on a train carriage full of white people. I heard comments like, "Oh, it's getting dark in here." Other comments like, "Be careful, because I was standing next to the door in the train. Oh, be careful, you know, be careful when you walk outside the door. You know, you need to hold your purse properly." You know, I just got it all from all angles and all directions. You know, and it's very traumatizing when you go through situations like that. Because you walk off the train very angry. I felt like I wanted to scream and just shout at all the white folks and just go crazy at them. But I couldn't do that. I had to keep my composure and then calm. But in saying that, following Sunday, because I work in a hardware store part-time, there was a white male who was with his partner, and if you could envision an aisle, and you're at one end of the aisle, and this man's at the other end with his partner, he began to whistle, and he was whistling, and you know, I was turning around thinking, okay, you know, why is he whistling? It wasn't like he was whistling to a song. He was whistling as if, you know, a person would be calling a pet, like a dog. So he was whistling, and his lady friend was laughing. She was just laughing. And, you know, he started to say, "Come here, boy, come here, boy." You know, he's whistling loud, "Come here, boy." And, you know, I just stood up and you know, the look that I just gave him, it wasn't nice. So, you know, he started to wave his hand like, come here, you know. And you know, I waved my hand and said, "No, you come here. So, you know, he ended up walking over with his wife and with his partner. And then he just asked me, "Oh, why didn't you come over? You know, I was calling you." And I said, you were not calling me, sir. You know, you were whistling." And then his wife just burst out in laughter. And, you know, they ended up just walking away. You know, they didn't want any help, you know. And it really stains your mind, you know. Really, 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 you know, stains your mind. There's a lot of tension building up in the city of London right now in regards to how white people feel about non-white people.
Hey, Scott.
Yeah,
I have had experience trying to whistle to get my attention, and something I found to be very, very helpful for me is to be absolutely aware of all sounds. Everything around you. The more aware you are, the better. Because I would have recommended that you never had turned around, never had even acknowledged it at all, that you heard it, it didn't pertain to you. So, you know, I'm aware, man. When I hear people try to call me, I've gotten out of so many situations walking past people that, you know, that could have been hostile, saying things to me, and I just totally ignored them because I just already had in my mind that they're not talking to me. You know, I have nothing to say to them, and whistles especially. So, I mean, you know, open your ears and really be aware. And if you hear something that you know, that you don't want to be identified with, ignore it would be my advice. Totally ignore it.
Yeah. I agree.
You know what, though? I hope, first of all, Mr. Nero makes it in. But I think we might be about to get cut off. Well, there's a price to be paid either way. I think that was really a good suggestion, but just keep in mind that being hypervigilant does cause things like insomnia and hypertension. I don't think there's any free ride under the system of racism, white supremacy. You're going to pay one way or another.
Well, I found ignoring things, especially in the situation I was in when I first adopted that practice. I mean, being in a very hostile environment, you know what I'm saying? Where you could, you know, very hostile environment where gangs and psychopaths running around, and as to being in conflicts with people, where I found myself thinking about the conflict and getting mad at the back and forth with black males or whatever, you know, like, you know, what are you talking about? Why are you even coming at me like that? You know, blah, 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 having some type of conversation, trying to explain myself, whatever. I found that to be way more stressful than when I just ignored them. I didn't even think about it because I didn't turn around to see their face. I didn't look in their eyes. I didn't have any contact with them either, you know, back and forth or whatever. So it was much easier for me to just put them out of my mind, out of my existence. You know, they didn't even exist for me. So, you know, it's just a suggestion that's I definitely found it less stressful, less mind taxing. Very less stressful than trying to communicate with somebody that just is looking for a weakness. Looking for, you know, just any type of stupid conversation where they can attack you on it. You know, I just...
We are actually 2 minutes over. Mr. Nero, are you at a spot? Because I did want to hear the remainder of the story. I think at least me and Cree did want to hear. I don't know if the rest of the folks, if they... caught that part, but are you close to getting to a spot where you can finish that up, or not really? Or
Gus, unfortunately, I'm not, sir. We just have to pick it up some other time. Just remind me on the next show I call in on.
Okay, I'll do it. No problem. We'll hang that for perhaps tomorrow. Maybe that'll be an added bonus. We can finish that program up, that aspect up tomorrow. I did want to point out again, I was not being crass. That was a direct quote from Mr. Jaspin's book, the white people that he was defending and saying that they were most definitely not racist. These were great folks. They were the folks he was talking about who were saying that the racial cleansing in Forsyth County didn't happen. They were the same folks who said, we're not going to use the term racial cleansing. These were the same white people who were saying that we don't really have any proof that the black people's property was stolen. Records, you know, they seem to indicate that a lot of these folks got to sell their land for market value, and there was no theft of land. You don't have any proof that there was theft. These are the same white people. And then when the evidence began to suggest otherwise, as opposed to saying we made an incorrect report, we didn't say the correct thing, or perhaps we were practicing racism, a white person said, in quotes, perhaps we can just say it was half-assed reporting, directly from his book, a direct quote. that was what they were willing to say, as opposed to we reported incorrect information, perhaps we were practicing racism, protecting a blatant act of white supremacy. It was half-assed reporting.
Wow. Hmm.
We have silence. Does anybody have anything to share? Anything pressing you want to get out today?
That just reinforces the notion that black people have never owned anything.
I like listening when people come to their, well, like personal things, like what he said about the undertow of history. That was his that was like a personal feeling that he had. When he started talking about baked into the genes, bred into us, those were little personal tidbits. I find those little personal. When people bring out those things, I find those things interesting, actually. And when he was talking about the hanging, the public hanging, I was thinking about, and you were talking about Sky Drifter, the match with England. You know, I'm familiar. I love the Premier League. I love soccer. I love Arsenal. That's one of my favorite teams. That's one of my favorite sports. It's blood. The blood, the thirst for blood. Like a public hanging wasn't enough. Once you get that taste of blood, and it's on. You feel me? Just like England lost, okay, now it's on. You know, they got that. All they needed to do was just, I mean, I'm sure there were assaults. And then from that one assault, just, you know, one assault, you know, one hanging, and black people were witnessing the hanging. Next thing you know, they were given the ultimatum to get, you know, to get out. And I think that's that blood. That I really see it as, you know, once you get them going, man, that's just something that I've been noticing, man. It just takes one spark and then to explode the situation. And the personal things that he said, I found it kind of interesting, because when Mr. Nero asked the question that I was going to ask, okay, you're talking about the enticement laws. You're talking about these labor laws that were illegal. You're talking about the property laws that were, you know, those things are illegal. So my question is, but you can see just from his personal statements that he, asking him that kind of question, I don't know where would you go for that, but I think it's a good question. Like you got it right here. That this is all illegal property laws, major acres of land, and. Like, what are you doing here? You know, what are your people doing here? Like, what are they doing? They should be, I mean, you know, and then he said he had a gold-plated, or gold, he used the word gold in education. he didn't say ironclad. He said, like, gold, a golden education. You feel me? He was educated to his statement, golden. So you're benefiting from all of this illegality. You know, and then
yeah,
you're surprised.
But
I was just gonna say, you're surprised when people ask you, "Well, how do you feel about?" I mean, how do you feel about? It was, you know, I mean, the judgment. What's up, man? It's coming. What do you think about this country? You know what I'm saying? This is. The Gus said it's horrific. This is one of those shows that really gets your blood boiling, man. I mean, these people were totally displaced, threatened, killed. I mean, it's just a nightmare. And you're benefiting from it. You're getting ironclad, golden, goldenly educated off of all of this.
Man, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was going to ask the question, and I kind of felt maybe I'm out of place. But does that not, like, this story, this this interview, did it not piss anybody else off? I mean, maybe it's just a personal thing, and I've studied racism, white supremacy, the history, but for some reason, every time I hear a story such as this, I don't know, I just get infuriated all over again.
I'm going to pause it right here because we went 9 over the time, and I have a show tomorrow, so I need prep time and sleep time and, you know, all that stuff. In case anybody was not angry about this program, I feel it would be fitting to end with a passage. Actually, the passage is in the description for the program, just for anybody who's listening and they're not at Blog Talk Radio or listening and they have not seen the description. I'll read the passage, and yeah, that'll be a fitting end. This is page 61 from Elliot Jaspin's Buried in the Bitter Waters, The Hidden History of Racial Cleansing in America. What followed was an orgy of violence. On May 17th, 1918, two blacks were grabbed at random by a mob and quite literally shot to pieces. It was estimated that 700 bullets were fired into them. The next day, Hayes Turner, suspected of being part of the black conspiracy, was lynched. His body left hanging for 2 days became a grisly tourist attraction for local whites. Attraction. Sidney Johnson was tracked to Valdosta and shot to death. When Turner's wife, Mary, threatened to find his killer and swear out arrest warrants, her unwise remarks, unquote, became a death sentence. The day after her husband died, the mob grabbed Mary, 8 months pregnant, hung her upside down from a tree, and doused her with gasoline, set her on fire, then disemboweled her and tore out the fetus. The baby gave a feeble cry before a member of the mob stomped it to death. Although the exact death toll will never be known, the mob murdered at least 11 people. Page 61, Buried in the Bitter Waters, The Hidden History of Racial Cleansing in America. And this episode has nothing to do at all with Forsyth County. This is one of the other many episodes. He said 260 suspected cases of this sort of activity. We'll be back tomorrow. Replace white supremacy with justice as soon as possible.